Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. On Monday, President Trump unveiled his version of the government's budget for 2019, and it caught many by surprise. It wasn't just the massive increases in spending, inflating a ballooning budget. It was the massive cuts to the country's safety net for the poor. Nearly $2 trillion gone from food stamps, Medicaid, public housing, new job requirements for benefits. This hour on Point, President Trump, Congress, and slashing social welfare. You can join us on air or online. Are you okay with slashing the social safety net? Is it overdue or a travesty? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now, first from Washington, is Liz Goodwin, a political reporter for the Boston Globe. Her article yesterday was headlined, Trump and House GOP Push for Stricter Work Requirements for Welfare. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for being with us, Liz.
Thanks for having me on, Jane.
So President Trump's $4.4 trillion budget, we're looking specifically at these social service programs that would be impacted. What do you see in these cuts, Liz?
So one of the biggest shocks on the Hill yesterday, because lawmakers actually weren't in the loop on one part of these safety net cuts, was this idea from the Trump administration to, instead of giving people who get food stamps a card that they can use at the grocery store with a set amount, you can't buy alcohol, but you can basically buy the food you want with it, they would give people a box of food called the Harvest Box. That would just show up on your doorstep once a month, and it would have shelf-stable milk, all canned foods, nothing, no fresh produce, no meat. And that would be a way to cut the SNAP program, the food stamp program, by 30% over 10 years, which is a huge, huge cut. And so the Trump administration was proposing to pay for some of that cut with this box of food.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a shock on the Hill because, as I say in my article, House Republicans have been pushing for cuts to programs that serve the nation's poor. But this kind of headline, no one really wanted this idea of delivering canned foods and no fresh produce and Blue Apron and all that. So
let me play a clip from that, Liz. Here's Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, talking about what you're saying here, the food box delivery program. It's called America's Harvest Box.
The food box program, one of the most innovative things. Actually, I think it originated at the USDA. Secretary Perdue wanted to give it a chance. We thought it was a tremendous idea. So what we do is propose that for folks who are on food stamps, part of their benefits come in the actual sort of, and I don't want to steal somebody's copyright, but a Blue Apron type program where you actually receive the food instead of receive the cash.
So just for the record, Blue Apron is a company that sells weekly meal service kits. They come with ingredients and recipes such as salmon and spiced vegetables. They're cooked at home by the customer. Three meals a week for a family of four comes to about $140 in the New York area. So that sort of idea, the comparison maybe quite didn't work, but caught by surprise, lawmakers on Capitol Hill, Liz, were they supportive of it?
No, there's no support for this idea on the Hill, but there is a lot of support for this idea of tightening requirements for food stamps, Medicaid, and even public housing. And that's something that the right flank of the Republican Party has been pushing for a while. They wanted to get it in tax reform. They wanted to get it in healthcare repeal. And they really feel like it's time for the president to deliver on this promise. You know, he kept saying next time, the leadership says next time we'll get to it. And now, especially since they've been on a bit of a deficit spending spree and Republicans are very nervous about getting that reputation that is not mm-hmm. a good political look for them, they're looking to make cuts somewhere. And I think that the president has promised not to significantly touch Social Security or Medicare. So they really want to target Medicaid, public housing, food stamps.
So $250 billion in cuts in Medicaid, as I understand it. Tell me about these job requirements, the job training aspect of the president's proposals.
Yeah. Yeah, so on food stamps, right now you have to be working if you are a non-disabled adult without children. You can only get food stamps for 3 months. But there's been, if you're a parent and you're poor, you don't have to work right now. You can stay on food stamps, or a lot of people are working and have food stamps. But if you can't find a job, that's okay. You can still get your food stamps because you have this dependent. And basically what this plan would do was try to kick off parents who don't have infant children, unless they're able to work 100 hours a month. So the issue with that is that a lot of people have child care problems. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do with their kid for 100 hours a month. They don't have support there. So advocates are saying this is going to result in more hungry people in the country.
So the president's plan dovetails on that point with proposals from House Republicans to reduce spending on entitlement programs, as you said. And Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, has referred to that as sort of workforce development. This is sort of an umbrella term for what we're talking about here?
Yes. Yeah, so workforce development is basically a way to make the idea of welfare reform a little more politically palatable, because Republicans are aware that the retort is going to be, so you cut taxes just so you could kick people off welfare. And they don't like that framing. They don't want that framing. So they're focusing on the fact that they're not kicking people off. They just want people to work, and that they're going to spend some investments in workforce training to try to get people better skills so they can get better jobs. And mm-hmm. The idea is that we don't want people on welfare. We want them moving into the middle class and working. But advocates, you know, anti-poverty advocates are just saying that the child care issue is so huge that when you're putting these stiff work requirements on these programs, you're essentially going to kick people off. And in polling, the idea of cutting welfare does not poll that well, but the idea of work requirements does poll well. A lot of people support the idea of requiring some work. So that's why you're seeing that branding of workforce development versus welfare reform or welfare cuts.
Also quickly, last question, Liz, proposed cuts to rental assistance for poor people, nearly $1 billion?
Yes. Yeah, so the Trump's budget proposes a steep cut in public housing and assistance for poor people to get in housing, and they also propose work requirements for public housing. And so that's going to be if lawmakers adopt that would be a big change. I would add as a caution, the Senate has a very narrow Republican majority. A lot of these proposals are going nowhere.
Liz Goodwin, we'll keep watching, political reporter for the Boston Globe's Washington, D.C. Bureau. Appreciate your time and information, Liz. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Before I bring in my next guest, let me play this clip. Marcy Coburn runs a nonprofit that manages several San Francisco Bay Area farmers markets where food stamps can be used to buy fruits and vegetables. She told the local ABC News affiliate that she thought the pre-made box of food idea, which didn't include any fresh food, was a bad idea.
It's very disappointing news. We feel that just because someone collects EBT or is on food stamps, that they doesn't mean they shouldn't have choice about what they eat or what they buy.
So let me bring in now from Tucson, Arizona, Marco Liu, the director of advocacy and outreach at the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. He's been involved in hunger relief efforts in Arizona for decades. Marco, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me on, Jane.
So politicians are in Washington. You are on the front lines. What do you make of the proposed cuts to these social programs, most specifically to food stamps and food delivery?
I think I had the same reaction as most of the national and local advocates did, is that it's a very big idea. I don't want to necessarily dismiss it out of hand, but for the safety net program called SNAP, it's really the primary hunger relief safety net program. It's a lot more complicated than just having a big idea. And so my first reaction, honestly, is that this is a program that I believe is one of the better run programs, one of the more efficient programs. And so to try to change it structurally, it doesn't make a lot of sense without having a lot of input and having it vetted and lots of questions that mm-hmm. are currently unanswered.
Republicans and many others, frankly, say that there are abuses in the system and that this is an effort to try to clean that up. Do you see that on the ground, Marco? And do you think some of this will help?
You know, over time, there have been abuses. We have to admit that that's been the case. But ever since they introduced the electronic benefit transfer technology, that has been significantly reduced. And I believe the USDA data will show that it's the integrity of the program is at its highest level in all of history.
What's the demographic of the people you serve at the food bank there in Tucson? And how has that picture changed over the years, Marco?
Well, the demographic, obviously we're in the Southwest, and so we have a high Hispanic population, but it's very diverse. Arizona happens to be a service industry type of state, and so the wages tend to be a lot lower than some of the industrial states. But it hasn't changed a whole lot. We've seen a lot more in terms of SNAP participation. We've seen a lot more working poor mm-hmm. over the years, but I think that's typical across the country.
Mm-hmm. And what are people talking about with regard to this proposal, if at all yet? But what is their reaction generally, or what do you think it will be?
I think the biggest thing is all of the unanswered questions. So, for example, providing a commodity box as part of the benefit. What happens with individuals that have food allergies? What happens with individuals that have medically related, diet-related restrictions? What about individuals that, you know, especially for us down here with large Native American populations, there are cultural food choices that may be ignored by just receiving various commodities that the federal government decides to provide.
So, Marco Lu, there you are in Tucson, a director of this food bank there. What do you worry most now about these proposals in this new budget? Don't know if they're going to become reality, but as you look ahead, what do you think?
Well, quite frankly, as an advocate, I'm a little bit cynical. I know that when they introduced the tax reforms in December, we kind of saw that this was going to be coming. As the speaker indicated that entitlement reform was on the next docket, and we just see this as the next step in trying to undermine the safety net programs. As your earlier guest pointed out, it goes across the board. You know, when they talk about the job growth and the economic growth that's going to happen, and they say that the additional deficit of $1.4 trillion is not going to be realized because of such mm-hmm. great job growth. Mm-hmm. You know, the SNAP program is designed to actually follow that kind of trend. So if they believe that economic situation is going to occur, then the SNAP program would automatically adjust to that. It would go down just in terms of people getting to work and the wages increasing.
I see it. Marco Lu, Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona, I so appreciate your time today, Marco. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about President Trump and Congress's proposed overhaul of the welfare system this hour, and you can join the conversation. Do you agree with the president's proposed welfare work requirement? Is that an unfair burden on struggling Americans? Or does there need to be a better vetting system to cut out abuse? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here is White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney yesterday testifying before the Senate Budget Committee on Capitol Hill on President Trump's 2019 budget proposal.
We do some tremendous, I think, new ideas on things like food stamps and the farm bill, other mandatory spending. There are some good ideas out there in this budget that the legislature could take up to get real long-term savings.
And Mulvaney actually told lawmakers at that hearing that if he were still in Congress, he would not vote for the $4.4 trillion proposal he was presenting. Here now is President Bill Clinton in his welfare speech in January of 1996 at the White House talking about the law that created the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which helped pregnant women and families with children pay for food, shelter, and utilities.
A long time ago, I concluded that the current welfare system undermines the basic values of work, responsibility, and family. Today, we have an historic opportunity to make welfare what it was meant to be, a second chance, not a way of life. And even though the bill has serious flaws that are unrelated to welfare reform, I believe we have a duty to seize the opportunity it gives us to end welfare as we know it.
There's Bill Clinton with his proposals back in 1996. Let me bring in now from Naples, Florida, Taryn Bragdon, president and CEO of the Foundation for Government Accountability, an organization that advocates welfare reform and supports work requirements. From 1996 to 2000, he was a Republican member of the Maine House of Representatives. Great to have you with us, Taryn. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
So we just heard from Marco Liu down there in Tucson, Arizona, who runs a community food bank. What did you hear in his comments? I'm curious.
Well, I think we see that there's a lot of need for individuals, but at the same time, I think that we have agreement that the best solution for individuals, whether they're hungry or out of work, is to get them back to work so that they can provide for themselves. And that's exactly what work requirements within welfare does.
You say that dysfunctional welfare traps people in dependency, and you say restoring dignity and self-sufficiency is the way out of dependency. So to your mind, do these new work requirements do that?
They do, and we know that from the experience within the states, that states that implement work requirements, whether that's the example that you highlighted in the clip from Bill Clinton with welfare cash assistance, the TANF reforms of 20 years ago, or states that have work requirements for adults without kids in food stamps, that these individuals move off food stamps, they go back to work, incomes double over the next year, and they get out of poverty.
Mm. During the campaign, candidate Trump often spoke about the quote-unquote forgotten men and women of our country. He said he would be their champion. He promised not to cut Medicare and Medicaid and other programs that benefit poor and middle-class families. How do you think these proposals in this budget square with that, Taryn Bragdon?
Well, I think that there's a real difference between reforms to entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare and reforms to welfare. And I think you're seeing the president make that distinction in his budget. The welfare programs, we need to ensure that we're taking care of needy Americans, but the best support that we can provide is to move them to self-sufficiency, and the best way to do that is through a job. And so I think he's being consistent with the rhetoric from the campaign and his promise, not touching entitlement programs, but focusing on opportunity for Americans by reforming welfare with work requirements.
And so do you support these requirements? You support the cuts more broadly. Do you think they go far enough?
I think that the best reform is a work requirement. I think there are some other structural changes that you talked about, but we're most focused on not how do we change people's experience as they're in poverty or dependency, but how do we quickly get them out of dependency, out of poverty, back to work and onto a better life. So that's what we think is going to be the most transformative thing, not giving them a different kind of fish, if you will, but actually getting them a job where somebody pays them to accomplish something and they can use that money however they want.
Let me bring now another voice into the conversation from Washington, Rebecca Vallis, Vice President for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, a progressive public policy research and advocacy organization. She's a former legal aid attorney and policy advocate at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia, where she worked directly with low-income individuals and communities. Thanks so much for being with us, Rebecca. Glad to have you.
Thanks so much, Jane.
So you hear Taryn Bragdon there saying the best welfare reform is a work requirement. Help people get back up on their feet through work. To your mind, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I think the first thing that people need to understand is that President Trump and Speaker Ryan can dress up cuts to programs like Medicaid and nutrition assistance and affordable housing with puppies and rainbows language like workforce development all that they want. But let's be very clear. Taking away health care and food and housing away from unemployed and underemployed workers, and that's what they're proposing to do here, that's not going to help anyone work. And that's because the dirty little secret about so-called work requirements is that they don't actually help anyone work. They don't create a single job, they don't raise anyone's wages, and they don't address the real obstacles to work that millions of Americans are facing, whether that's needing additional skills and job training, whether that's long-term services and supports if you're a person with a disability, whether that's access to childcare or transportation or all of those kinds of real-life barriers that people are facing. What they're proposing to do is to kick struggling workers while they're down and then call that workforce development.
So we heard President Clinton back in 1996, a few minutes ago, talking about his work requirement, his efforts to seize the opportunity to end welfare as we know it. And he sought stiffer work requirements for temporary cash assistance for poor families. And then a Republican-led House crafted a bill. Both parties backed it. I mean, is there a compromise here?
Well, I think the thing to know about what happened in the 1990s, and I'm so glad that you're bringing that up, because the fact is we've seen this movie before and we know how it ends. And I have to respectfully disagree with some of what was just said before, because it misstates some of the history here. What happened in the 90s as part of what Bill Clinton billed as ending welfare as we know it was the conversion of the main cash assistance program for poor families with kids into a flat-funded block grant that hasn't increased over time, and that has meant that far fewer people are now actually getting help. Very, very few, just one in four poor families with children now actually get help from that kind of assistance today. And what we saw happen after those work requirements were put into cash assistance in the 90s was that while there were some early gains in employment among recipients of assistance, thanks in large part to the strength of the labor market during the booming economies of the 90s, those gains, unfortunately, proved to be very short-lived. And so very few recipients of TANF, of the new program created, were able to secure stable or long-term employment with decent wages. And actually, most were ended up left without assistance, even though they hadn't found work. And so, that's what we're going to see again if we repeat the mistakes of the 90s.
Taryn Bragdon, jump back in here. Do you worry about that, these short-lived gains, these short-term solutions that Rebecca Vallis seems to be describing?
No, I think the important thing to understand is that when we say work requirements, that's work, train, or volunteer. And it only, unlike what Rebecca was implying, it doesn't apply to individuals with disabilities. Nobody's talking about that. It doesn't apply to the elderly. It does not apply to kids. We're talking about able-bodied adults for whom both doctors and social workers say they're able to work and who don't have very young children. So that's who we're talking about, work requirements, and it's work, train, or volunteer. And we know that individuals need to engage. We don't want folks to be isolated, to be removed from their community. They need to engage. If they need training, absolutely, get that training. If they only have an opportunity to volunteer, we still know that that's a great pathway to get a job. And the only way out of poverty is to get a job and work. I think that it's the very definition of failure if we're touting how many people remain on a welfare program rather than touting how many people get off the welfare program and become self-sufficient. That's what we should be looking at as the measure of success.
I've got a bank full of calls here, and I want to get our listeners into this. Let's go to Aaron in Johnson City, Tennessee. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Yes.
I wanted to comment on the food stamp cuts. I'm a 25-year-old grad student. I have a son who's 3 years old. And for the past 3 years, I've relied on food stamps to be able to make health-conscious decisions about what I feed my family. And I share in the frustration with a lot of Americans when I see people using their food stamps to buy junk food and soda and candy and things like that. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. But I don't think this is the way to go about doing it, particularly because I buy a lot of fresh fruit. And I think, you know, if I'm getting a box every month, I'm getting canned fruit, it's probably going to be, you know, in heavy syrup and a lot of sugar. And I don't want all that. So I think this needs to be addressed. but it's a bad way to do it.
Aaron, thanks for the perspective. Let me get Andrew in here from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I grew up on food stamps, and kind of sort of what Aaron was saying is that a lot of families will buy, my family included at the time, will buy more expensive products or things that aren't shelf stable or things like that. And then you get to the end of the month and, you know, you've got no food left. So I think the quote harvest box is a good idea as long as a portion of food stamps is still being delivered, you know, to be able to spend in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, thank you very much. Taryn Bragdon, we heard Liz Goodwin talk about the harvest box and liken it to Blue Apron at the top of the program. Is there a marketing issue here? Did they go about this in the wrong way? It's a good idea, branded really maybe inappropriately?
Well, I think that the administration is focusing on making sure that individuals have good nutrition while they're receiving food stamps. And I think that that's a worthwhile cause to be focused on. But I think the biggest thing, and what we know most Americans agree on, is that we don't want to make the experience of being in poverty just a little more nutritious. We actually want to get people out of poverty as quickly as possible. That's the goal. And that's why I think the bigger effort that the administration's focused on with expanding work requirements in food stamps is really going to be the most transformative. And that will allow individuals to have much more money to buy whatever type of food they want to provide for their family, but also to be able to afford a better place to live, a safer neighborhood, and the whole host of other opportunities that will mean a much brighter future.
Rebecca Vallis, the harvest box idea, maybe a good idea, bad branding?
Yeah, I think on the harvest box note, right, we have to remind people this is in addition to calling for huge cuts that to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which would take food assistance away from more than 7 million Americans by our calculations at the Center for American Progress. But I think in a lot of ways, this harvest box idea is really another example of how conservatives who claim to be the party of smaller government are huge fans of big intrusive government when it comes to poor people. Right. So I think we have to ask ourselves the question, what problem is this trying to solve? Our friends at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities have calculated that the boxes alone, not even the food, just the boxes, would cost some $130 billion over the next 10 years. What about homeless people who don't have an address to ship their box to? Right. What about the fact that fruits and vegetables aren't even going to be in the boxes? I think the folks who are most eager to see this proposal enacted are President Trump and his Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue's friends in Big Ag, whose pockets it would line.
Let me get Sivana in Macon, Georgia. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Sivana. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I am on permanent disability for 6 chronic illnesses. I received the senior SNAP benefits,
mm-hmm.
a total of $181 a month, which if you break down the numbers, comes out to $47 a week. I am extremely opposed to the food box. I buy nothing, if at all possible, except fresh fruits and vegetables. I don't want somebody dictating to me what I can eat and what I can't eat. I think it's insulting at the least, and it's utterly ridiculous in the extreme. I do remember former President Reagan having once said, I believe this when they were trying to get more nutritious meals for kids in school, that he thought ketchup was a vegetable. That's about the way I feel right now.
What about, Sivana, what about the people who say, you know, I don't really want to give a loaded debit card to someone to take to the grocery store. I think it's better we give the food and there it is.
But whose food? Who says what is good nutrition? Who defines that?
Sivana, thank you. Thanks very much. Let's get Benjamin in here from Richmond, Kentucky. Hi, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a board member of a co-op which operates a farmer's market in Richmond,
mm-hmm.
and we accept WIC and SNAP,
mm-hmm.
and I can tell you from firsthand experience that the majority of the money that I see is going towards fresh produce. That's at least how a lot of our farmers make, you know, between 7% and 10% of their income is through these these programs. Mm-hmm. We like to think that it's largely used that way. However, I can't tell you how many times I've seen around the first of the month carts full of soda pop going out the door and likely going towards smaller mom-and-pop stores that retail them elsewhere.
Benjamin, thanks. Rebecca Vallis, you've got to admit there are abuses in the system. Benjamin makes reference to them there.
Yeah, there's actually a study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that took a look at the spending habits of families helped by nutrition assistance and families who are not turning to nutrition assistance. And they actually found, looking at that exact myth and narrative that's out there, oh my God, all these folks are buying unhealthy food or lots of soda. They actually found no real significant differences between the purchasing habits of what's in the shopping cart of a household helped by food stamps and a household that's not. But I think that really misses the point, right, to focus on the myth or that narrative that's sort of out there that people are making unhealthy choices because that's what they want to do. If we want to arm families with what they need to make the healthiest, most nutritious choices at the grocery store, then what we need to be doing is making sure that their nutrition assistance mm-hmm. is actually adequate to afford mm-hmm. healthy fruits, vegetables, and other kinds of things that can cost more than junk food.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about President Trump, Congress, and slashing social welfare this hour. You can join the conversation. Is America officially becoming a nation of haves and have-nots? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Taryn Bragdon, the President and CEO of the Foundation for Government Accountability, and Rebecca Vallis, Vice President for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress. I wanted to get this clip in. Despite working as a full-time employee at Walmart in Orlando, Florida, Lisa Lopez had to apply for food stamps to support her family. Here is Lisa in a YouTube video she made talking about her struggle.
I had to apply for food stamps because I wasn't making enough at Walmart. I get like $44 a month in food stamps to help with a little bit of our groceries at the house. It's still not enough. I had to go and get a second job. There were times I couldn't afford to buy food. We basically had bread and water, basically, because we couldn't afford it.
A lot of comments on this point on our website. Here's one that is a representative from Kent. He says, many people who get public assistance do work, like at Walmart and McDonald's. They don't make enough, even full time, to make ends meet. Same with food stamps. So, Taryn Bragdon, speak to that point. There's Lisa in Walmart in Orlando. She is working. She's got a second job, apparently, saying there. I mean, you know, food stamps and public service goes to help people who are working full time who still can't make ends meet.
Absolutely. There's a portion of individuals who are able-bodied adults like Lisa who are receiving food stamps and working full-time. We know that that's a small share. It's about 14% of able-bodied adults on food stamps. But absolutely, it's there for her and her family. And she would not be impacted by the work, train, or volunteer requirement because she's already meeting it. But at the same time, we know that two-thirds of able-bodied adults on food stamps, and this is from USDA data, have no reported income from work. So they're not working at all. And for those individuals, they need to take that first step to work, train, or volunteer to get on the path out of poverty and to get back to work. And for those individuals, this work requirement is going to be very effective. There are 6 million open jobs across America right now, yet we have 21 million able-bodied adults on food stamps, the vast majority of whom are not working at all. And we need to make sure those Americans are not on the sidelines, but they have a lot to contribute to society, and we want to engage them and have them take some of those 6 million open jobs.
Let me get another call in here. Zakia is calling from Stanton, Virginia. Hello. Welcome to the program.
I had three I have three comments. The first one is it is absolutely absurd, I think, to give a box to someone in replace of their SNAP card or those that cash benefit each month.
Why, Zakiya? Why?
Because it takes away their self-worth and value. I was a a benefit worker. I processed SNAP, TANF, and Medicaid for 5 years. And one thing I noticed is that when people feel better about themselves and the choices that they're making, they will actually go out and get jobs and so forth and so on. That's a part of the self-sufficiency aspect of TANF. The other thing I wanted to say is, yes, I could see how a work requirement, work trainer volunteer requirement could benefit SNAP. However, if you're going to implement that, then you have to be willing to invest in the training aspect. When you say get a job, you can't say get a job at McDonald's because that's $7.50 and they're going to work their hind parts off and then quit next month when they realize they can't even make enough to pay their rent. Okay, so if we're going to force them to work, we have to train them. And either that or raise the minimum wage. People have to be able to secure sustainable wages in order for them to stay off this program. The last thing is you can't make those changes without raising the limits for SNAP, TANF, and Medicaid. Right now they haven't raised in quite a while, and that's Xing out a lot of people. And so what they're doing is they just quit working just so they can have that supplement.
Got it, Zakiya. Great points. Thank you very much for making them here. Let me get Robert in here from Central City, Kentucky. Hi, Robert. Thanks for waiting, and we're glad you called.
Yeah, hello. This my parents, they receive a box here in Muhlenberg County. They have a supplemental thing for elderly and people who are underpaid. Mm-hmm. And they receive a box that has cheese, storable milk, canned food, things you know you could use.
Yeah.
And this program that he's offering, it may not be such a bad idea, but they need to make sure that they still have a money allowance on a SNAP card for, like, purchasing meats or maybe something a little different than what's coming in the box.
Some sort of combination of the two. Robert, I hear you. Thank you very much. I want to go back to Zakiya and a point that she made, Rebecca Vallis. When she said that some of this takes away self-worth and value, I mean, even the word welfare is so loaded. You know, we encode it in such a negative way. You know, you're a taker, you failed. I mean, I guess the truth is that not everybody is born on equal footing, right? I mean, and on the flip side, many Americans want some of these abuses cleaned up. How do you serve both of those ideas, Rebecca?
Yeah. I'm so glad that you made that point, Jane. I mean, welfare, let's actually get this out there in the open. Welfare is a term with a deeply racially charged history. It evokes decades of racial stereotypes about who is poor in this country and who needs to turn to public assistance to make ends meet for their family. And so we're watching President Trump and Speaker Paul Ryan use dog whistle terms like welfare and in many ways actually try to redefine programs like Medicaid and nutrition assistance as so-called welfare, really as part of an effort to try to paint people who turn to these popular programs as modern day so-called welfare queens, right? So that we don't notice that they're coming after the entire working and middle class. It's really an attempt at racial divide and conquer. But I want to go back to a point that Zakiya made, because this is so important, right? President Trump and Speaker Ryan tell us all the time that the best way out of poverty is a job. But what they hope that we forget about is that a big part of the story here is an unforgiving low-wage labor market that's dominated by poverty wages, as Zakiya was describing. She mentioned that the minimum wage federally hasn't been raised in years. It's actually 8 years, to be precise. And so as a result, a minimum wage worker today has to work an extra 3 months just to earn the same in real terms as she did in 2009, the last time that it was raised. And so as a result, many low-wage workers end up needing to turn to public programs like Medicaid, like nutrition assistance, which in many ways have come to function as work supports when wages aren't enough. So I would put this question to President Trump and to Speaker Ryan. If they are serious about shrinking programs like the SNAP program, then they should be all about raising the minimum wage. Because if you were to raise the minimum wage, even just to $12, not even the $15 that some people are talking about, you would see $53 billion in savings in the SNAP program over the next decade because families would be able to afford to eat on the wages that they're working really hard to earn.
Let's go to Gabriel in Columbia, Missouri. Gabriel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to speak on the logistical aspects of these food packages. I worked in Springfield, Missouri as a homeless service provider, and our little tiny office had about 50-plus homeless individuals in on a normal day. And when they put in the work requirement after 3 months for food stamps in Missouri, our office exploded with hundreds of people coming in because they had nowhere to get food when they needed it, because there's only certain times you can get food at other establishments that serve homeless people. And so it took our community months to get a formalized process established with food pantries to actually hand out food. And in the meantime, we were calling ambulances every other day for people who were exhausted, dehydrated, and starving.
So just from a logistical standpoint, you don't think the box program will work, Gabriel?
I think it's going to hit lots of communities very flat-footed and unprepared, like it hit ours. I mean, it was pretty rough.
Gabriel, thank you very much for that. Let's get Rosalind in here from Cumberland City, Tennessee. Hi, Rosalind. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. My comment concerns the food boxes.
Okay.
I do not receive government assistance. I'm very fortunate. But I do volunteer with a food pantry. The logistics, as the other gentleman said, of delivering food boxes. I live in a rural area, lots of dirt roads and back roads. That would be an issue, the cost of delivering food boxes. Many people live in areas that the food box would be gone in 30 minutes before they even got it because someone would have taken it. There's also the issue of, are they going to customize food boxes for people who have food allergies, who are diabetic? There are so many logistics that they have not mentioned. And where do the fresh fruits, vegetables, and meats come from?
A lot to think about, Rosalind. Thank you very much. Taryn Bragdon, I mean, it does sound like a logistical challenge at best for certain populations and certain areas of the country.
Jane, I think it does have some logistical challenges. I'd like to respond to Rebecca's comments because she just a couple minutes ago called me a racist and apparently everyone else who supports work requirements for individuals in welfare and suggested that even referring to the program as welfare, as Bill Clinton did, is apparently some sort of secret dog whistle to raise up racist individuals all across the country. I think that that is so fundamentally offensive to just American compassion. We know from surveys that 90% of Americans support work requirements in welfare. So I don't know if Rebecca believes that 90% of Americans are racist. But at the same time, I just want to challenge her. It is not compassionate to just keep people in poverty for a long period of time. 40% of all able-bodied adults on food stamps have been there more than 8 years. That's not success. That means they've been trapped in poverty for 8 years. That is failure. And I think rather than just simply say more of the same and celebrate more and more people being on food stamps or being on other types of welfare programs who are able-bodied, instead we should say these Americans have so much to contribute to society. We want them to engage. There's 6 million open jobs across the country. Mm-hmm. We're missing out as a country. And they have less opportunity for their family. So how do we move them from the sidelines, have them work, train, or volunteer, and earn more money so that they can be part of their own American dream?
I'm looking at the results of your poll, Taryn Bragdon, and I'm seeing here 83% of voters you found support work requirements for food stamps. 81% of American voters support work requirements for public housing. Rebecca Vallis, what about that? I mean, these are ideas that many Americans seem to think are pretty good.
Yeah, I'm really glad that we're digging in on this. And to be clear, I'm not calling anyone racist. I'm certainly not calling you racist, Taryn. But I do think that it's important to take care with our language, because language choices do matter. And words like welfare that do have deep racial histories, it's really important for folks to be aware of those and not just to be repeating dog whistles that are still in use. And I would argue intentionally so by many policymakers who are trying to smear what they know to be popular programs in an effort to make it harder harder for them, make it easier for them to cut them. So to the polling question, this is actually a really timely question because we at the Center for American Progress actually just did some polling that we released just a few days ago on this very point. And what we found is that despite some polls suggesting that there may be some support for the idea of work requirements, we found that this support evaporates when Americans understand the consequences of this kind of policy. When you take away the puppies and rainbows language about promoting work or about work requirements, and people understand that it would result in taking Medicaid and other basics away from people if they can't find a job or get enough hours at their job or face barriers to work, 6 in 10 Americans oppose these policies when they understand those consequences.
Taryn Bragdon, I'm running out of time. What's your response?
Americans support and are very compassionate, but they also recognize that the best way out of poverty is a job, and that work requirements have meant that individuals move into more than 600 different industries, the amount of time they spend on welfare is cut in half, and they become self-sufficient. I think that's what all Americans want, and they recognize that welfare is also a relationship, that we give individuals assistance, but for able-bodied folks, they need to contribute back.
I got to get Shane in here from Prestonburg, Kentucky. Hi, Shane. I'm glad you called.
Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just want to make one quick point. I have a sister that is 26 years old, never worked in her life, never is going to work in her life. She has two young kids. She receives $603 a month in food stamp. My mother keeps both kids up. She takes the food stamp and will trade, sell half of them for pennies on the dollar so she can go buy drugs. You know, and I don't know if there's any way to police this, but in Eastern Kentucky, this is a major problem, and I'm sure it's a major problem elsewhere also.
Shane, thank you very much for the call. Rebecca Vallis, a lot of Americans point to Shane's story and stories like Shane's and say, there you go. That's what we want to fix.
Well, and if folks want to get serious about making sure that fraud and abuse of the SNAP program, which is less than one, less than 1% currently, we know that from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. If we want to keep it at less than 1%, we need to adequately fund the program to ensure that enforcement is there, right? But that doesn't mean let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. That doesn't justify taking away food from the tables of 7 million Americans when we know that investing in adequate nutrition is what allows children to be able to learn in the classroom and adults to be able to succeed in the workforce.
Taryn Bragdon, I'll give you the last word. You've got 15 seconds. Wrap us up here. What do you want us to remember from this conversation?
What Shane wants for his sister is what all Americans want, which is individuals in poverty to get a job and become self-sufficient and experience the American dream. And work requirements does that.
Well, we will keep watching this proposal, the president's budget, everything that's in it. What a great conversation today with Taryn Bragdon, president and CEO of the Foundation for Government Accountability. Taryn, thank you very much for your perspective and your time today.
Thank you.
Rebecca Vallis, vice president for the Poverty to Prosperity program at the Center for American Progress. Great to have you, Rebecca, and thanks for your thoughts.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Listeners, thank you, as always, for excellent contributions. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, move over career politicians. Teenagers are getting into the political game. We'll look at six teens who are running for governor in Kansas and what they have to offer. I'm Jane Clayson. Until then, this is On Point.